This is a 3CR podcast.
And this is Published or Not. I am amazed how some people can speak so many languages and people can read body language better than others. But through this book today, it's made me very aware of another language, and that is of music. Indiana Schneider has written a wonderful book, Since the World is Ending. Welcome, Indiana.
Thanks very much for having me.
The word lust in German means more than sexual longing. It means appetite, delight, desire, gusto and joy. And this is where the book starts, with Maya. And I'm going to get Indiana to read from page.
Her dark eyes are open now, sleepy, velvety brown. She looks my naked body up and down. Lust hushes my mind, focuses my thoughts, melts any lingering drowsiness. I usually try to avoid sleeping with other musicians, though they are sordidly good in bed. Something about the rhythm, maybe, or the coordination, or the dexterity. Oh well, this is casual. I lean into her. Soothing lust, playful lust, slows everything down so I can feel things one at a time.
So this is Maya. So you better tell us who she is and where she is.
Of course. So
apart from bed.
She's in bed with her colleague Lucia at the moment, who is a cellist. And Maya herself is a violinist in a young artist program, which is a kind of a musician's first foray into professional world. And she's in Vienna. She's living her perfect life. She's in with this orchestra, the sort of young Philharmonic, and she's playing music every day for the first time and, wakes up in bed with her colleague after quite a fun night, I think.
The book has a hectic time frame from Friday morning, waking up with Lucy Bizot, and then a phone call from Maya's past.
Mm.
Who's that from?
This is from her ex-boyfriend, the sort of big ex, as I think he's referred to, Josh. The book really is about what happens when your past comes knocking on your door and you've created this life for yourself and how easily that life can unravel. So it's set over a weekend. And the book begins with Maya remembering that her pocket was buzzing during the sort of early moments of her fun night, and then realizes it's a missed call from Josh, who is arriving in Vienna with something to tell her.
Since the World is Ending, the title of the book, and you will have to read the book to find out why Josh thought the world was ending and his decision to visit Maya in Vienna. Their relationship broke up 10 months ago.
Mm-hmm, exactly. So I think for Maya, Josh is symbolic of stability and this really wholesome, beautiful life. He's an English teacher in London. They have met and kind of started building a life together when she realizes it's just not the life she wanted and moves to Vienna to pursue that life.
The childless, adventurous, quasi-nomadic life I left him for.
Mm.
But for Maya, there is rehearsal. Lucia Rizzo, cellist extraordinaire. Mm. So let's hear a little bit more from page 13.
Because absolutely.
This is Maya listening to her. Not only is she good in bed.
thank God she's also good at music. Okay. The first time I heard Lucia play, I imagined her cello was filled with bodily organs. An instrument with lungs that breathed when she breathed, whose beating heart kept time with hers. I stood outside a practice room, my ear pressed to the door, and listened to the blood in her music. It haunted me how the sound she made felt more human than weeping or laughter.
Maya is awed by the fact that so many great musicians and composers have been in this opera house before her. The orchestra she is playing with, maybe a bit stereotyped, are really all brass sections, heavy drinkers.
You know what I did is because I'm an opera singer, so I have a lot of friends who are musicians, but not so many who are in the orchestral music world. So when I was studying in Germany, I sat down with a bunch of instrumentalists and sort of said, okay, tell it to me straight. What are the stereotypes? What would a violinist be thinking? What are the expectations she'd have around different musical instruments? And found out some very fascinating things and included some of them here.
Oh, well, hopefully not that the percussionist from Slovakia was harassing the Swedish bassoonist.
Mm,
Your own knowledge, is sexual harassment in orchestras typical?
I think what is typical is that an expectation of sexual harassment changes country to country. And in a career as international as music, you kind of have to adjust your expectations of what is okay, depending on where you are, which is a horrible thing to say. And also, I think as a freelance artist, you don't want to be difficult. And it's a tricky situation for a lot of women in various, I'm thankfully not have had to experience this, but I've heard a million stories, and deciding what to do in those situations is often really, really tricky. And I really wanted this book to feel very real and timely. So it's included here as well.
So it's Friday morning, and into the rehearsal comes Lorenzo Garcia, an obscenely handsome guest conductor, and after hearing Maya plays, offers her an audition on Sunday. So Maya knows that serious practice must take place. But there is fun to be had on Friday night. What had her Australian writer friend, Georgia, organised?
Well, Georgia was a very fun character to write. I think you sometimes need a character with just like a lot of life and personality, especially in a book that's like a very tense, steamy weekend. So Georgia has organised an evening of painting and Prosecco, where she arrives at Maya's house with canvases and popcorn and a lot of booze, and has a fun evening in store. But yeah, we'll see what actually ends up happening.
No, well, it wasn't. Maya had to be careful because she had serious practice to do for this audition.
And this is another theme I wanted to explore a bit, is the sort of interplay between discipline and catharsis, or sort of letting go as a musician, because it's hard. It's hard to live the kind of life that requires so much discipline constantly.
Oh, so Josh and Georgia get into the Prosecco and the painting.
Mm-hmm.
And Josh sleeps on the couch. Mm-hmm. So Saturday morning, Maya leaves her apartment with Josh on the couch to have a Zoom meeting with her therapist. It's hinted that there was something that triggered a panic attack, and she has devised a behaviour of having a memory draw.
Yes. So I think another thing I really wanted to explore in this book is how to perform with honesty. And obviously as an opera singer, there's text for me there. But as an instrumentalist, what does it mean to have an emotionally honest performance or to connect to a piece of music? And one of the ideas I had, which ended up coming being quite a big theme in this book, is that Maya likes to, or used to enjoy, choosing a memory from her past and associating that memory with a particular piece of music in order to embody it with feeling and to communicate those intense feelings. And so she developed something called a memory draw, where she had all of these memories from her life that she would draw upon in order to play music, until things went down, which I won't spoil, where those memories were actually more hindersome than helpful. And she was told by her therapist she needed to lock this memory draw. And what does that mean as a musician, to sort of take yourself out of your art and like for the safety of your mental health? And what does that do to your performing? Those are some questions.
We don't know why until the end of the book, but we do know that she will not touch Brahms.
No Brahms.
Look, there's another piece in this book that I just thought was beautiful, and it's about the violin and the player and how the player really takes that musical instrument as their own.
Yeah, I think the relationship between a person and their instrument is a really special one, and one you don't often see explored. And as I say, I'm a singer, so my instrument is inside me. I've never seen it. I hope it's there. But I've definitely spoken to a lot of instrumentalists about their relationships with their instruments, and it's fascinating the different sort of conversations people have with
their instruments.
Yeah, and obviously not actually conversations in real life, but in this book, I wanted to explore what they would look like. And
well, let's hear it.
Despite what my violin says, I don't think about how I want the music to sound. I don't want to listen to this music. I want it to taste like red wine, to smell of roses. No, fire, smoky embers. I want it to feel like someone is pulling you towards them, running their fingers through your hair, down the sides of your neck. I walk past my memory drawer and into an empty room.
Then there are two empty pages, and it continues.
Sweat covers my face in a slippery sheen. I lie on the floor, holding my violin like it's a bouquet, like I'm dead, like we're together in our coffin. But I'm the opposite of dead. My every cell is pulsing with adrenaline. My body is an instrument, percussive, vibrating, primal, hot, wild, thoughtless. Feeling is the opposite of thinking.
Oh, Jesus.
Oh, thanks.
Well, that's after the rehearsal, and then they're off to a party. And they have to write a piece of poetry to enter this party. And it's there she finds her audition for the next day, Sunday, is cancelled.
Mm-hmm.
So she drinks.
Let's rip.
And this is where you've created a different type of writing in the book.
Yes.
We have We have sideways writing.
Yes, yeah, which I was so pleased when my publisher said that that was allowed to happen. This book is so minute to minute. You know, it's set over a weekend. I have friends who've read it over a weekend. They read Friday on Friday, Saturday on Saturday, and so on. And I wanted the book to feel really like you were there in it with her. And basically, because I said before, there's this whole interplay between discipline and surrender. What shall she do? What shall she do? And this happens a lot to instrumentalists and to singers as well, is that you find out about this audition, you cancel everything and you practice, and sometimes it's canceled and it's horrific and heartbreaking and, you know, it causes existential crises for some people. And so Maya, upon finding out that this audition that she had been working so hard towards is canceled, yeah, really lets go and gets really drunk. And I wanted the reader to feel drunk with Maya, and so sort of experimented with loads of different writing styles and ended up basically trying to make the writing drunk. So the writing hiccups and it moves on the page, and when she lies down, the writing is on the side. And yeah, I think it doesn't feel gratuitous. I hope it doesn't come across as gratuitous. I really just want you to be in Maya's head and as her thoughts, you know, she forgets words and adjectives and she doesn't know whether she's thinking or speaking. And I think you're hopefully right there with her in that drunken state.
So Sunday morning, hungover, there is another rehearsal to get to, but Josh is gone. In the preface, there is a quote from Kafka: "When the world is ending, we are going to love each other without scruples or fear or restraint." So we won't tell the reader who it will be for Maya. But at the party, you actually have another look at conductors. One of the females there is a conductor. And you write, "Conductors are completely dependent on the players, the only musician in the room who makes no sound."
Yeah.
So I like the fact that this conductor at the party would look at the people and work out what instrument they would play.
That was a lot of fun to write as well, actually. And again, as a singer, I sort of have a lot of relationships with conductors, and it is really interesting because they often did study an instrument and then decided actually they wanted to lead. But again, they're the ones that make no sound. And it's this like real intense question of authority, because they are in charge of the room, no questions asked. Except if the orchestra is not on board, the conductor can get fired. They won't like listen. And it's a really, really, I think, really fascinating relationship of an interplay of like power and politics.
Well, they talk about actors being a triple threat, who they can sing, dance and act. But I think Indiana Schneider, the opera singer, the salsa dancer, the cook, the runner, and the very good novelist.
Thanks very much.
You pick all of these.
I actually suck at the three in between. They're just sort of really fun hobbies. I write short distance runner on my biog, so you know that I like the feeling, but I'm terrible. I would never be able to run far.
So what makes an opera singer want to write a book?
That's a good question. I think it's a really – people expect opera singers to be very creative, and there is so much sort of creative work that you do. But often you are a puppet in someone else's creative fantasy, depending on the director. But I can have a director who says to me, "Go stand on the right side of the stage and raise your right arm when I..." And you have to do that. And that's great. And you end up creating a really beautiful collaborative piece of art with lots of people. Or if you're in a revival, you just do what the person before you did. And I think I was really craving some creative autonomy and actually being able to choose, make more creative decisions. So that's, I guess, part of it. And then the other part of it is, as I say, as a singer, you have to be so, you don't have to be extroverted, but you're in a setting with a lot of people. It's a collaborative art form. And I love reading. I love the quiet as well. And I was really craving some sort of initially hobby that was much more reserved, much more sort of isolating in a way. So the two play off each other actually really, really nicely. But I actually wrote this novel, my first novel I wrote before I was a singer professionally. I wrote it on the tube to a job I was doing to save money to become a singer. And I was really heartbroken and just wanted to write a story to explore a question that I was boring my friends with, which was, that's my first book, 28 Questions. And then really enjoyed it.
A remarkable novel about lust, not just for a person, but for music and the consequence of choice, in Indiana Schneider's Since the World is Ending. Thank you, Indiana.
Thanks so much for having me.
And now we have a bit of spying and espionage with Sam Guthrie's The Peak. Sam Guthrie takes us into the ruthless and deadly world of international and domestic politics in his psychological thriller, The Peak. So, Sam, welcome to 3CR.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here.
A political book. It's a timely book in some ways.
Timely book. Attempted to write something that was as close to the world in which we live as possible and hopefully that illuminates some of that world.
Now, we've got Charlie and Sebastian, and they've been friends for years. What are their current roles, and where did this friendship begin?
So these are two people who are long-term school friends. They met in a private boys' school, and in the fire of schoolyard bullying, of trying to find themselves, of new friendships, new love, new vulnerabilities, they came together and have always looked after each other.
But this trope of the schoolyard plays itself out all the way through the novel. I mean, Charlie at one stage is called a class traitor because he's on a scholarship sort of thing. He doesn't belong. So how does he compensate for that?
The book is dedicated to lifelong school friends, because I think that what happens in the playground, as you say, then sets the course for the rest of someone's life. What they experience in their vulnerable years as a child replays out again and again throughout their period. So Charlie is someone who started life in a working class family. He went to a local public school, and then through the, you know, the hard work of his parents and his own sort of scholarship minded success, he lands himself in this private school. And yet immediately he feels like he's an outsider. And that's the outsider feeling that I think carries him throughout the course of the novel as well.
But also, you want acknowledgement and acceptance from others. There are people betraying each other in the schoolyard.
Yeah. I think the outsider is always driven by a desire to fit in, a desire to be safe and not be persecuted, and a desire to forge those relationships where there is loyalty. And the thing that terrifies them the most is to be pointed at as someone who is outside, someone who is different, someone who should be attacked or persecuted for being that way. And that is Charlie's great fear and concern and experience in the at the hands of the schoolyard bullies. And the reason that he loves Sebastian so much is that Sebastian steps between him and those bullies, and he makes him feel all those things. He fits him in. He gives him loyalty. He gives him that security of friendship.
Well, this transposes to the political arena, because one of their roles in the political realm.
So we first meet in the very beginning of the book, Charlie and Sebastian, some 30 years after their schoolyard days. And Sebastian has become a senator and an assistant minister of foreign affairs. He's an aspiring prime ministerial candidate. Charlie is his chief of staff.
But he's called a hatchet man.
Charlie is his chief of staff. He does the knife work in the dark, as we describe it, and has a reputation for having felled former prime ministers and having competition with other members of his own party.
But what does this say about the nature of politics and basically how it plays out in the international framework where we're trying to bring other countries down?
I think in the nature of our own domestic politics, you want to fit in, you don't want to be the outsider, you want to inspire loyalty, you want to feel a sense of security, you want to signal your success. That's very much within a domestic situation. And on the global stage, that is also very much the case. There are countries in Australia's region that have perhaps felt insecure in the past, that have perhaps felt somewhat persecuted in the past, and now act as a result of that history in a way that is maybe more dominant and looking to strengthen their position into the future. And the rest of the region needs to respond to that.
But how stable is democracy if one of the fundamental sort of approaches is to try and bring down, do a hatchet job on the opposition?
One of the risks for democracy is that our short-term, and I think the book refers to it as a university politics approach to politics, distracts us from the more important questions of the day. And one of the reasons that I wanted to write this book and to talk about the big issues that confronts Australia, this is a book, you know, there's been a lot of books in this espionage genre which talk about the Cold War or talks about the Middle East. But this really is about confronting the major challenge of our time, which is about what happens in the Asia Pacific between the US and between China. Australia is right in the middle of that. And so my argument is that we don't have a lot of time to spend it with infighting and schoolyard politics and backstabbing. What we really need is a well thought through policy. We need our leadership to be very, very strong and focused on these complex issues. And in order for us as a democracy to make sure that we get that outcome from our leaders, from our policymakers, we as individuals also need to be conversant in the issues of the day. So the purpose of writing this book is not only to tell a cracking story, not only to have all the twists and turns and tick all the boxes of a great thriller, but also to talk about these issues. Because if we're not educated in those issues as citizens, how can we possibly vote in the right direction when it comes to making a decision about policy or leadership?
But can we trust our politicians?
Putting trust to one side, it's easier to assess our politicians if we understand the issues that they are navigating.
And how they operate, which is often according to the rules of the playground. The novel begins with Sebastian committing suicide, having received a cryptic message from a contact in China. Charlie attempts to try and control the narrative. The irony being is that Charlie's the one telling this story.
This is very much, at the beginning certainly, Charlie's story. Charlie is leading us through the narrative, and we sort of are living viscerally through his response to this horrific act that Sebastian has committed. And we see it on the two levels of the external, where he is trying to control the narrative, and he's, you know, driven by that sense of loyalty. He's worried about protecting his friend's reputation, protecting his family, protecting the secrets and the history that he knows exist and date all the way back to 1997 in Hong Kong. So he manages the narrative accordingly. But internally, he's still grappling with that he doesn't understand the narrative, that potentially there's another narrative. Why has his friend done this? And what doesn't he know?
Well, it's the narrative of the country in terms of how the country is endangered if this information gets out. But much of what Sebastian has done, well, his suicide, relates to a girl in China, Chloe Zheng. And again, the schoolyard comes into play here as well, because Charlie was interested in Chloe, Sebastian was interested in Chloe. There's all of this betrayal and even an attempted sabotage of relationships going on here.
Yeah, so the heart of this book is exactly that. It's a love triangle. A love triangle that takes place back in 1997, when Hong Kong is being handed over from the UK to the People's Republic of China. And yep, Sebastian and Charlie, they are just a couple of years out of school, and they travel together for the handover, and they meet Chloe Zheng, who is a young Chinese woman. They meet her in the midst of all this celebrations about the handover, and they go out to bars, and they experience such a historic moment. But both Charlie and Sebastian fall in love with her. And then, yeah, you're right. We see elements of the playground as they struggle for her attentions, and their loyalty is tested. And it does result in a betrayal that haunts all three of them for the rest of their lives.
It all now relates to the broader political framework. And you've brought up the narrative that held sway for quite some time. They all came to marvel at the Chinese economic miracle, believing in the same platitudes Sebastian had uttered to Chloe and me in Hong Kong, that China's economic reforms would lead to political reforms, that just as Beijing would embrace the global economic order, it would one day also embrace democracy. Only now, these weren't Sebastian's personal views, but a script of influence provided by the MSS. There's this notion of how we thought things would work out, how the political forces thought things would work out, but it's all unravelling.
Yeah, I mean, and this is, I've spent 25 years in international relations, and particularly working with taking Australian companies to China and building those relationships, both in the private sector as well as working within the foreign affairs portfolio. And you can see an absolute difference between at the beginning of the 2000s, 2010, rivers of gold were flowing, relationships were strong, it was a win-win situation. Fast forward to 2016, 2019, and even if a couple of years ago when there were $20 billion worth of trade barriers against Australia's products going into China, there is a clear difference in those 2 points in time. Yes, I think that there was a lot of, you could almost argue that it was something of an arrogant view of Australia and the US and others that, of course, China would just over time turn into a democracy. They would adopt Western values and they would be like one of us. But if you go back to your schoolyard analogy, you know, China went through a hellish period. They will talk about 100 years of shame that they suffered, the schoolyard bully of you know, colonial action. And now they've grown stronger. And as they say, China is standing up. And it's about how the West then reassesses that position of the West to China and comes to terms with, actually, we are confronting a much more complicated reality, a reality that doesn't inevitably need to lead towards conflict, but a reality all the same where there are different powers, there are different senses of loyalty, and there are potential betrayals and implications for people like me when doing that sort of trade engagement.
But even within this narrative, you've got the disillusionment within China because Chloe's parents were part of the initial revolution, but they've become disillusioned.
There's certainly a lot of focus on ideology and what ideology does both for a nation and for a family. And you know, there were I was in Hong Kong during the Hong Kong protests, and I knew a lot of the young people that were involved in those protests and saw that there was a lot of fracture between them and their parents, for example. Their parents didn't want the street protests and thought they were quite naive because it was going to, you know, ruin one country, two systems and the freedoms that they already had in Hong Kong, whereas the young people wanted to be on the streets and protesting for, you know, something that they believed in should be happening right now. And testing those sort of that sort of family tension, intergenerational tension, that's, I think, replicates what Zheng and the family also go through in the book.
But also the original political revolution was a naivety of its own that sort of plays out over time, and then you lose belief in it, which is what happened to the Zheng family. But Sebastian has been influenced by the Ministry of State Security, and we can't necessarily give this away, but talk about psychology. He's given something he desires, and then when that doesn't sort of work out, they give him the opposite. But that turn is extraordinary in terms of maintaining the control over the individual and how one knows how to play that psychological weakness.
Yeah, and the book also makes the comment that approach, which we see in, you know, our classic understanding of how espionage works, it is about coercion, it is about compromising something or someone, is actually very similar to the way that we play our dirty politics as well. You know, let's present someone with something that they desire, be it a political position, be it a political donation. Let's give it to them. And then let's either threaten to take it away or threaten to expose that they've taken it. And I think it's quite interesting that you see that play out in our regular domestic politics, and you also see it in the context of espionage.
Is this book a warning?
This book talks a lot about a cautionary tale. And it echoes some of the things that we see when, for example, the ASIO director once a year will get up and have a statement. And those sort of statements talking very frankly about some of the threats that are targeting Australia, giving a cautionary advice to people who are potentially considering doing something that might compromise them.
In the end, we have an ambivalence. Sebastian is described both as a traitor and the most loyal person I have ever known. Charlie juxtaposes all that Sebastian sacrificed for Chloe with his own cowardice. Does the human condition prevent politics from actually working?
I don't think so. I think the book is quite critical of blind ideology. And I think it's trying to encourage a degree of critical thinking and not being trapped into seeing things in a box. The struggle of Chloe is a struggle for Chloe to have freedom and to think more broadly. Sebastian has one way that he would like her to think and believe and act, and her father has one way for her to think and believe and act. I guess my argument in the book is that none of us should fall prey to ideology. We should all stay open-minded. And going back to the point about democracy, a democracy functions when the citizens are understanding and engaged in the big issues of their time and then can vote accordingly.
Well, the citizens in this case are the reader and the listener. They're going to have to get the book The Peak, which gives us details about that political relationship between China and Australia. The author is Sam Guthrie, and it's a HarperCollins release. So, Sam, thank you very much for talking with me today.
Thanks for having me.
You've just been listening to Published or Not on 3CR.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.